Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Legal Experts.
Good morning and welcome to another episode of Atlanta Legal Experts. I am your host, Emily Rowell with Peachtree Offices, and we have a great lineup of experts ready to talk about our hot topic today, which is nursing home abuse. And I'm excited to announce we have Aaron Marks here with the founder of the Marks Law Group. He is a personal injury attorney specializing in those representing who have been injured. Personal injury attorney specializing in representing those who have been injured and killed through the negligent operation of non-emergency medical transportation. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, Emily.
Sorry I messed that up a little bit.
It's all right.
Steve Apolinski, good morning.
Good morning.
Founder of Apolinski & Associates, LLC, he is a trial lawyer with almost 30 years handling wrongful death and serious injuries cases. And we also have Sarah Watchko.
Good morning.
Good morning. She is with the firm Bettis, Hill & Van. She focuses on estate planning as well as elder law and special needs planning. Thank you for being here. We have a full table here today. Jeff Warnicki also is here. Good morning.
Good morning.
And he is a partner with the firm of Evans, Schultz, Williams, and Warnicki, LLC. His practice focuses almost exclusively on representing policyholders in insurance claims. And last but not least, we have Nathan Woody. He is a lawyer with the law firm of Corrales and Woody. Good morning.
Good morning.
And he exclusively represents injured workers in Georgia. This show has been brought to you by Peachtree Offices, helping attorneys build their business by establishing a professional image in Atlanta. Our other sponsor is 3A Law Practice Management. They are devoted to helping lawyers start and grow their practice. And we also have Atlanta's own John Marshall Law School as a sponsor as well this morning. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. I'm going to go ahead and start with Aaron Marks. We're so glad that you're here today and you brought these guests with you to speak about nursing home abuse. Aaron Marks is the founder of Marks Law Group, and he is a personal injury attorney specializing in representing those who've been injured and killed through the negligent operation of non-emergency medical transportation. Non-emergency medical transport is any transportation to and from medical treatment by a third party. Many people take non-emergency medical transportation to dialysis, to their doctor, and to and from a group home. These vans are so prevalent, you've probably passed one going to work today. So tell me about more people, different types of people that take those non-emergency medical transportation.
Sure, Emily. Well, for example, Nathan Woody's here. He's talking about workers' compensation. All of his clients who need treatment, who can't transport themselves to treatment, are treated in non-emergency medical transport. And that's paid for by the insurance company of the employer where they were working when they got injured. For example, Steve Apolinski, he investigates nursing home abuse. Mm-hmm. His clients, when they leave the nursing home, they go to dialysis, they go to get treatment, they're transported by a third-party non-emergency medical transport company.
Okay.
If you're an older American, if you're an older person in the United States and you need treatment to any kind of medical facility and you don't have family to take you, you're usually taken by non-emergency medical transport.
Gotcha.
So it's extremely prevalent, and unfortunately, it is almost completely unregulated. And so you have individuals who are really qualified to move used furniture, picking up and transporting our grandparents, ourselves, and these are the people who are least able to advocate for themselves. And
right.
When I say advocate, I'm not saying that they're... It's not that they're inarticulate, it's that they're medicated, and so they can't say
sure.
things like, I'm not clicked in, or my wheelchair is loose, or you're driving too fast. And when accidents do happen, and they invariably do happen, the results can be catastrophic, because if I were to fall off my chair here, I'd get a bruise, but if you're in advanced diabetic and you have renal failure, you fall off a chair and you can shatter your hip.
Right.
So that's what I enjoy doing, is going after those companies and making sure that they play by the rules and take mm-hmm. responsibility for their actions.
So not only did you possibly pass one coming to work today, but most likely because it's so prevalent, and there's so many people that use it, there's somebody in your family that
there
uses
is.
Them.
There is. And I actually had a close friend who went from Emory University on one side of Clifton to Emory Physical Therapy on the other side of Clifton, literally just across Clifton. And the driver got lost. My friend had to direct him to physical therapy. And this is the patient.
Right.
So, you know, it is it's a problem. But the more informed you are, the better you are at dealing with this proactively instead of reactively.
Sure.
And so, for example, for Sarah or for Jeremy, Jeffrey, they can advise their clients on what to look for when they're in these type of situations before something wrong happens.
Right.
Or so.
Yeah. And so if you're choosing, are you able to choose as a family member the non-emergency medical transportation?
If you're a Medicaid recipient, you are less able to choose because your transportation happens through the Department of Community Health.
Okay.
If you're a client of Nathan's, you have more choice. You can say, this transportation provider doesn't feel safe to me. Sure. I want a different one.
Okay.
And the insurance company most likely will comply with that request. If you're a private payer and you have private insurance, you have a lot more freedom.
Sure.
You can say, I don't like this company. I don't like this driver. I get a bad feeling about this person. And actually, interestingly, just recently in Colorado, there was a woman who got a bad feeling from her non-emergency medical transport driver, and she reported him to the Department of Community Health. And it turns out they hadn't looked into his record, but he was a convicted felon doing 20 years for murder. And he was out on work release.
No.
And in Colorado, they didn't screen him, and he was transporting her. And after like the third or fourth text message that he sent her, she said, this is really weird.
Right.
So, you know, it's hard to believe.
Not a normal guy.
I'm sorry?
Not a normal person.
Not someone you want around.
No.
Anyone, really.
Really.
But this is the sort of thing that happens all the time, and it's hard to believe, but, you know, there's almost no screening.
And okay, so they don't have to go through any background, so anybody can get a van.
You and I could buy a van and hire some convicted drug-using, really incompetent people and call it Emily and Aaron's non-emergency medical transport. We're in business.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so crazy because there's so many other businesses out there that do have to, like you said, like moving companies.
If you want to be a taxi driver, you have more regulation than a non-emergency medical transport.
That's insane.
So Sarah, Jeffrey, if you want to start a business with me, we're in business. Let's do it.
So what should people look for to make sure their non-emergency medical transportation is following the rules?
These are uncomfortable questions, but I think they're worth asking, especially if they're transporting your loved one. You want to ask if the employees who are picking up and dropping off your family member are actual employees or if they're independent contractors, because the company will take a lot more responsibility for their employees. Whereas if they're an independent contractor, the company sort of have a hands-off approach, which is not what you want. You want to know how many days or how many sessions of training they've had and what type of training. You want to know what their communication strategy is. Are they a company that is, you know, you're lucky if you get a call back in the next 48 hours, or are they answering their phones quickly? Are you getting people who are willing to communicate with you, or are they very standoffish? And then I would ask them, if you're concerned about a family member, let's say who has dementia, or someone who is often in a medicated state, what is your strategy in dealing with someone like this? And tell me an example of something you've done in the past to make sure that you're capable of taking this person to where they need to be.
Gotcha. And about the question, how long in business have you been?
Just that's a great question.
Because, I mean, you would know if they just started, you know, a month ago or a couple of months ago, that's not probably a good reputable company.
Yeah, I would be very wary.
Now tell me, if they think their loved one is being treated badly by these companies, what would they do? What could they do?
Well, if they're a Medicaid recipient, unfortunately, the only recourse they have, the only recourse they have is to lodge a complaint with the Department of Community Health.
Okay.
I wouldn't lodge a complaint with the broker because the broker has no business interest in doing anything about the complaint. The broker already has a contract, and they're just going to lose it.
Okay.
Lose the complaint. If they're a private insurance company, I would, if they have private insurance, I would no longer use that transportation company.
Sure.
And you vote with your feet and you don't use them anymore. And if you feel like they're a danger to others, I would report them to the Department of Insurance. Because actually, there's the only regulation is that you have to have a certain amount of insurance on your vehicle. And the way the gentleman in Colorado, the ex-murderer, got reported was because he lacked insurance.
Oh, not that's because a good one. That got him, though, so that's good.
Yeah, not the whole murdering someone.
Right, right.
The lack of insurance got him.
Well, at least it got him,
yeah.
You know, off the street.
Yeah.
I think one more question I had for you. If they were a Medicaid recipient,
mm-hmm.
the one thing that you could possibly do was maybe have a relative sit with them as they
yes.
go. Is that allowed?
That is allowed. More likely than not, you can get what's called a home health aide to come mm-hmm. with you.
Okay.
And I actually have a few cases where that home health aide has been another pair of eyes, gotcha. Another person to say, hey, let's slow down. This doesn't feel right, or this person's not clicked in.
Right.
And that's a great resource. You just have to be proactive.
Right.
I can't stress that enough to be, you know, if you get that uh-oh feeling, do something about it before something
sure.
happens.
Sure. Well, thank you so much. And we're going to look forward to hearing you when we discuss the Hot Topic discussion and throughout the show as well. If you'll let our listeners know how they can reach you.
They can reach me by calling my office. My phone number is 404-939-1485. They can also go to my website, which is Marks. It's M-A-R-K-S, lawgroup.com.
Awesome. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Emily.
Now we have Steve Apolinsky. Good morning.
Good morning, Emily.
How are you today?
Great. How are you?
Good. Thank you. He is the founder of Apolinsky & Associates, LLC, and he is in Decatur. Steve is a trial lawyer with almost 30 years of experience. Members of his firm handle wrongful death and serious injuries cases throughout Georgia and Alabama. Their verdicts and settlements exceed $25 million. Steve has been recognized as one of the top trial lawyers in Georgia and was a featured columnist in the AJC Ask the Experts section last year. For more information, go to his website at aa-legal.com. So tell me about where you grew up and how did you get into law?
Those are great questions, Emily. Thank you. Basically, I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, then went to Michigan for college, Emory for law school, and have been here in the greater Atlanta area for the past 30 years. And because I grew up in Alabama, I still maintain a presence and practice there as well as here in Georgia.
Good.
And I got into law. It's kind of the family business. My mm-hmm. father's a lawyer back there in Birmingham. And I decided to get into litigation, particularly to try and help people. It's the great equalizer as far as if somebody's been injured, mm-hmm. That we can advocate for them and try and make a difference in their life and every so often make changes in corporate America.
So obviously you handle personal injury cases.
Yes.
And you focus also on elder neglect. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. Generally, this is where a family member in a facility has been injured, either through lack of care, and they've fallen either out of bed or they may have supposed to be in a chair and they're not properly restrained and they fall and they injured themselves. Okay. A large part of our practice involves what are known as pressure ulcer, pressure sores, also known as decubitus ulcer type of injuries. And this is where a red spot becomes an infection. And it can migrate through different stages, and the bacteria and flesh-eating components can lead to it getting all the way down to the bone. There are times that people go into what's called sepsis shock and even die from it.
I've actually heard about this before. Yeah, it's rare, but it does happen.
Well, it happens more than
more often
you'd realize.
Oh, wow.
Unfortunately, a lot of people don't understand
right.
The hospitals and facilities. A lot of times will say, well, this just happened. There's nothing we could do about it. And what we find is there are times that there is more that could be done, that if
right.
you are proactive and treat it immediately, it doesn't evolve into a stage 2, 3, or 4.
Gotcha. So you probably work with a lot of doctors, and it's most likely specialize in this condition as well.
Yes. It's interesting that a lot of times the doctors are in effect independent contractors, and they just manage a facility, and that means that they go in once a week or once a month looking at reports, and they rely on the reporting of the hands-on caretakers.
Sure.
And the problems generally come where their facilities, that there's a high rate of turnover of the caretakers, or the
right.
hands-on people are not well paid and not well trained. And I must say it's a very, very difficult job taking care of the elderly, especially
sure.
when they're non-commutative.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important. And little things like just turning them on a regular basis, changing their sheets,
mm-hmm.
making sure they're properly bathed can avoid a lot of the problems that we see.
And I guess writing your notes thoroughly.
Yes.
For the reports for the doctor.
That's exactly right. And there are times that we'll see that the notes, they'll have charting parties on Friday where they'll manipulate the records. And again, a lot of facilities out there are very good and
mm-hmm.
Have wonderful people. But I tell people 20 or 30% of them have problems and have systemic problems.
Tell me a little bit more about your firm. Why should someone choose you and your firm?
Well, we've been doing this for a long time. I don't really have many outside interests other than shuffling my kids back and forth to sporting events.
I'm there with you.
So there's been a lot of trial and error through the years. I've been very blessed with some wonderful success stories, and I've had some spectacular defeats through the years. But we know what we're doing. We know how to handle these cases.
Mm-hmm.
And basically we say, you know, we're knowledgeable. We understand the industry. We have the financial resources to handle these cases. Very often you hire one expert, the other side hires two. You have to then decide, well, then do I get another one or not? The financial piece of it is not an issue. We're good about communicating with the clients, telling them what their options are. And some people want to go to court, and we have a wealth of trial experience, and those that don't want to go to court, we know how to handle their cases as well.
Sure, sure. That sounds wonderful. So tell us, how can our listeners reach you and get more information about your firm?
Three different ways to reach us. One is our office at 404-377-9191. People are welcome to email me anytime at steve@aa-legal.com. Or they can visit our website at aa-legal.com to learn more. And there's a mechanism for reaching us that way as well.
Great. Yes, thank you so much. And just to remind our listeners, this show has been brought to you by 3A Law Practice Management and PeachtreeOffices.com, and also Atlanta's own John Marshall Law School. You can see their links and their logos on our website at AtlantaLegalExperts.com. And thank you so much for staying tuned and listening in. We have Sarah Watchko this morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. Thank you for being here. She is an attorney with the firm Bettis Hill & Van in Alpharetta. And a graduate of Wake Forest University School of Law, Sarah's practice areas are estate planning and administration, as well as elder law and special needs planning. Sarah is one of only 9 certified elder law attorneys in the state of Georgia, certified by the National Elder Law Foundation. In addition to her practice, Sarah regularly engages in pro bono work and provides community education through speaking engagements and her blog, The Elder Law Update. A native of the Atlanta area, Sarah lives in Brookhaven, Georgia, with her husband, Jeff, and young son, Will. And tell me a little more about focusing on elder law, since that's the topic for today.
Elder law is, it's kind of a growing practice area. I think with the aging population, we'll probably see more and more elder law attorneys, and a lot of people don't know what that means. So I think it's useful to explain what elder law really is. One part of elder law, it's really several practice areas that are combined, which are, of course, all geared towards protecting and supporting the aging population. So part of that is what's traditionally known as estate planning. And estate planning is drafting documents to plan for the management of someone's assets while they're alive and the disposition of their assets when they pass away, and planning for healthcare decisions, living wills, common terminology in that area. Mm-hmm. Elder law is also planning for long-term care. So a lot of our clients are coming in saying, well, what if I need nursing home down the road? How am I going to pay for that? Are they going to take my house? Or, you know, what if mom and dad need care? Who's responsible for that? So planning for long-term care with government benefits like Medicaid and veterans benefits. Incapacity is also an issue. Dealing with incapacity. What if my mom never signed any of those estate planning documents, but now she has dementia and she can't make any decisions for herself? What can we do now? So often we end up in the court system having guardians or conservators appointed. And then there are just a lot of fringe issues that come up. We're trying to get mom into a nursing home. How does that work? Assisted living facility. We're having an issue with the facility. What can we do? Medicare issues come up. And you mentioned that special needs is also one of my practice areas. I think the common point there is special needs planning is someone, planning for someone of any age who has special need or disability, and making sure that they can maintain their government benefits, and protecting their assets so that they can stay on Medicaid or SSI.
Gotcha. So it encompasses all those things, whereas I was literally curious before we came on the difference between estate planning and elder law.
I think of estate planning as one of many parts of elder law.
Gotcha.
Like you mentioned, it's a very interesting practice area because there are so many different issues that can arise. It also makes it a difficult practice area because
sure.
even tax law and financial planning and issues relating to those topics come into play. Really anything that could affect the elderly. In some of those areas, there are a lot of resources available, for example, online that people can research. But for some of them, there are not. Like planning for government benefits, it's very difficult to find relevant information. Each state has different rules. The financial limits change from year to year. So
right.
We try to provide a resource for people so they can navigate better.
Well, that's wonderful. So tell me, how is special needs planning relevant when someone is involved in an accident?
Well, often, not always, but often someone who has a disability or special needs is on means-tested government benefits, meaning they're on SSI or they're on Medicaid because they have limited financial resources.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're involved in an accident and they receive a personal injury settlement, then that can knock them off their benefits. Their medical
gotcha.
Costs are going to be so high that settlement will be depleted and then they'll be back on benefits. So there are provisions in the law that allow people to protect that personal injury settlement or if someone gets an inheritance or comes into money some other way. So that's what we're doing.
Wonderful. So it's more planning. Now, I take it you work with a lot of life insurance, different insurance people as well.
Yeah. Life insurance comes into play. Long-term care insurance mm-hmm. is very nice to have. I'm always pleased when someone comes into my office and I'm going through their information. They need long-term care and I can see, oh, you have long-term care insurance.
Right.
That can provide a great benefit. Life insurance can be very useful for estate planning and for providing for, disabled children or family members so that when the family caregiver passes away, there is a pool of money that can be put in a special needs trust and used to care for the disabled person.
Sure. Now tell me, what happens if someone on government benefits receives money in a lawsuit?
If they got money in a lawsuit, again, that could kick them off their public benefits. So usually what we're doing is we're trying to engage with a personal injury attorney at the outset of the litigation, mm-hmm. making sure that the moment that settlement check comes in, it funnels directly to a special needs trust so that it never knocks the person off government benefits.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the special needs trust?
Sure. In general, a trust is a legal arrangement where one person, a trustee, or an institution like a bank as trustee manages money for another person, the beneficiary.
Okay.
So in the special needs context, the beneficiary is the disabled person. So the money is managed for their benefit by a trustee. It could be a family member, again, a bank service trustee, or corporate trustees. And the special needs trust is just unique because it's permitted by federal law. It has special rules and requirements. So it has to say certain things in the trust document. There have to be certain rules about what distributions the trustee can make. It has to be funded before the beneficiary is 65 for the special needs trust for personal injury settlements, for that sort of thing. So it's a type of trust that meets certain requirements. And by meeting those requirements, the trust funds are not counted.
So it's important to have an attorney, especially when you have a special needs child or even somebody that's an elder person, to hire you, somebody that focuses on that.
Absolutely. It's a very, very specialized area of the law, and it changes a lot. So
right.
People definitely want to make sure they have someone who is attuned to all that.
Well, thank you so much for contributing.
You're welcome.
We look forward to more later on in the show. If you can let our listeners know how they can reach you.
Sure. They can call our firm, Bettis, Hill and Vann, at 770-475-8041. Our website is bhvlegal.com. And they can also check out my blog at www.elderlawupdate.net.
Great. Thanks again.
Thank you.
And we have coming up next, Jeff Warnicke.
Good morning.
And I said that correctly, didn't
Yes, you did.
Thank you for listening so far and being patient with us
My
as we
pleasure.
Go through. Mr. Warnicke has been representing the sick and injured in Georgia for 24 years. He is a partner with the firm of Evans, Scholes, Williams, and Warnicke, LLC. His practice focuses almost exclusively on representing policyholders in insurance claims, with the major emphasis being the wrongful denial of long-term disability insurance benefits. Mr. Warnicke strongly believes that when people give up their hard-earned money for insurance protection, the insurance company should keep their promises. When poor health prevents people from working, Mr. Warnicke helps people through the often challenging claims investigation process and, where necessary, files lawsuits in the state and federal courts to enforce his clients' rights. Since 2003, he has recovered more than $25 million in insurance benefits for his clients, every dollar of which the insurance companies previously tried to deny. Wow.
There's
you work hard.
They keep us busy.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about long-term disability insurance, and is it pretty specific? It is a pretty specific legal practice, and how did you get there?
Well, I started out doing what Mr. Woody does here, which is representing injured workers in Georgia.
Okay.
I found out pretty early in my practice that I like representing the underdog, and there is really not much in life that makes you more vulnerable than being sick or injured and out of work, particularly if you're the primary breadwinner for the family. It's a very stressful time.
Mm-hmm.
Within a few years of doing that kind of work, I had some clients who had coexisting long-term disability claims. They started having problems, and we literally could not find anyone to refer them to. So I saw a need. I saw that for these people, these long-term disability benefits could mean the difference between keeping food on the table, paying mm-hmm. the mortgage, sending the kids to college while they were sick. And so I took it upon myself to learn that area of the law. I actually flew myself out of state to attend a seminar, bought some books, dug in, and a few years later, it took over my practice.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, and when you actually do a specialized area like that, it really benefits a lot of people.
It seems to.
Yes.
And
yes.
It's rewarding.
Yes, that was my next statement. Yes. Now tell me a little more about what long-term disability insurance is and why is it important?
Well, long-term disability insurance, like any other insurance situation, is where you enter into an agreement with a company that you pay premiums to in case some risk arises. And in this case, the risk is that you become too sick or too injured to do your job. And so fundamentally, you are trying to protect yourself against that outcome. And as you know, the bio alluded to, one of my sincerely held beliefs is I think there's just about anything we would all rather spend our hard-earned dollars on than insurance premiums.
Right.
And when things do go wrong, I really believe the insurance companies should do what you pay them to do.
And, right. And often, they try hard not to.
Oftentimes they do seem to try hard not to. Mm-hmm. However, despite all the problems that I encounter, I think long-term disability insurance is a very good idea. Statistically speaking, it is far more likely that that you will face an extended disability that holds you out of work during your working years than that you will die early. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have life insurance who are primary breadwinners, but don't go that next step to get long-term disability insurance. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is, financially speaking, it is a more catastrophic outcome to be sick and alive and still have to be supported and not at work than to have passed away.
Right, right. A lot harder.
It's harder on the family.
Mm-hmm. So tell me the difference between long-term care insurance and long-term disability. I know I used to be in the field and I got that question a lot.
Sure. Well, I've not handled long-term care cases, but my understanding is that that's just insuring for a different kind of risk, which is basically the risk of having to go into a nursing home. And it, as I understand it, some of the other panelists could probably clarify, but it helps to pay those expenses. Long-term disability is not tied to expenses. It's tied to your income. And so depending on the source of the coverage, you can agree that if you're out of work, the insurance company pays a specified monthly sum or that they will pay a percentage of your income as it existed before you became sick.
That was a good answer.
Thank you.
So what advice?
I have done this before.
Yeah, that's why you're here today. What advice do you have for someone who has long-term disability insurance and is experiencing a health crisis?
Well, before you get to the claims process, I would like to say, too, it's important to look at the coverage that you may or may not have.
Okay.
There are a couple of things that really make big differences in the coverage. One is the source of the coverage. Without getting into the technicalities of it, a lot of people have coverage only through their employer, mm-hmm. and that invokes a specific federal law called ERISA, which, let's just say, is much, much worse than the alternative. Because of the remedies and procedures and on all of the obstacles to holding insurance companies accountable, ERISA and federal law sort of invites more abuse. Mm-hmm. And so for every call that we get that relates to a problem with a private insurer, we get 30 calls for problems with coverage that's provided through the employer. So that's a starting place. And then the nature of the coverage, like anything, the devil is in the details and you get what you pay for with this kind of insurance.
Sure.
So you have to look at that. When it comes to, you know, an actual claim, you know, God forbid your health takes a turn for the worse, I think it's important to advocate for yourself and be proactive. You'll get a claim form that asks you to check some boxes about how long you can sit and stand, and that may not be what the case is about.
Right.
You may get a claim form that your doctor is supposed to fill out. And what I always tell people is, go ahead and fill out the forms, but tell your story the way it needs to be told.
Mm-hmm.
And so sit down, you know, and write it out or have someone help you write it out and explain what you did for a living and how you became sick and why it is that you can't work anymore in plain English. And unfortunately, the insurance companies don't tell you that.
Right, of course. But it's good to have everything in writing.
Oh, yeah.
And I like the way you say, tell the story. That helps to understand the situation more.
It does.
So tell me, what advice do you have for people whose claim has been denied?
Well, as soon as you get the bad news, that's when you basically need to contact a lawyer.
Okay.
And time is of the essence, particularly with those cases that are governed by that federal law that I alluded to earlier, ERISA. There are some incredibly short deadlines to try to fix the problem. Under those claims, once the claim is denied or the benefits are terminated, the claimant has 180 days during which to ask for what's called an administrative appeal. It's basically asking the insurance company to reconsider its decision.
Okay.
More importantly, it is the last opportunity in the life of the claim to submit proof of the claim. And so lay people who try to handle that process on their own frequently do a poor job, do not develop the proof that's needed to be able to enforce their rights later. and they do irreparable harm that a lawyer cannot fix later in the process.
Gotcha. So you got to go to a professional.
You really need to.
So tell our listeners how they can reach you.
Sure. The law firm is Evans, Scholes, Williams, and Warnicke, and we can be reached by phone at 404-841-9400. We have a website that is actually devoted specifically to this practice area, which is called GeorgiaInsuranceLawyers.com. That's all one word. We recently retooled that website. There is a ton of content and also a contact form.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
To help everybody that's looking for some solutions.
Thank you.
Now let's focus on Nathan Woody.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Corrales and Woody, LLC. And that is also in Decatur, Georgia.
Yes, ma'am.
He exclusively represents injured workers in Georgia, helping them pursue claims for disability and medical benefits after an accident on the job. He has been handling workers' compensation cases as the majority of his practice for 10 years and has brought hundreds of cases to verdict and or settlement. Even though his practice is centered in the Atlanta area, he handles cases all over the state of Georgia. If you or a loved one have been impacted by an injury on the job, please do not hesitate to call Nathan at any time. There's no charge to speak directly with him and ask him questions about the workers' comp law and process, and to determine if a lawyer is needed to get the case on the right track.
That's right.
And that would be you.
That's me.
So what are the most common type of occupations you see workers' compensation cases in?
Well, that's a good question, and I like it in this setting since our roundtable, we've been discussing a lot of issues in the medical setting, but if you think workers' compensation, you're typically thinking about a construction worker, a factory mm-hmm. worker, and those are both areas where you'd see a lot of injuries. I've represented more nurses than any other profession. Nurses and certified nursing assistants, or CNAs, and that's kind of a surprising fact, but just revealing that a lot of professions really do have a very physical component that you might not think of initially.
Right. Now, what type of injuries for nurses are you seeing?
Gosh, a lot of orthopedic injuries, back issues, shoulder issues, knee issues. Probably the best way I could explain it is if you've ever tried to pick up a child that didn't want to be picked up, that went dead on you all of a sudden, and all of a sudden it felt like a sack of potatoes. Well, imagine folks in the medical field that are moving around full-size adults, and if an adult passes out or goes limp, or that individual's in a wheelchair and you're trying to pivot them from a wheelchair to a bed by yourself, you're lifting a tremendous amount of weight.
Sure.
And unless you're in a daily workout routine where you're ready to handle physical duties like someone in the NFL would, you're not going to be prepared to lift a 200 or 300 pound person when they go limp.
And you do it regularly, then you're really starting to take a toll.
That's right.
And tell me, what are the issues that are typically disputed in workers' comp cases?
All kinds of issues. As Mr. Warnke was saying, insurance companies, they're in business to make a profit, mm-hmm. Which means if there's an opportunity to deny a claim or just deny an expense in a claim, they'll do it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times, even with cases that have been accepted, we're fighting over particular medical procedures. Surgeries are big ticket items that
sure.
they would love to deny. In this day and age, pain management is a really big part of the medical specialty that tends to handle workers' comp. And so things like spinal cord stimulators are very expensive. But you'll also see cases where just absurd things like an orthopedic toilet seat, I think, was one thing I saw that was denied one time and, had to go to hearing on that issue.
Oh, my goodness.
And then sometimes they'll deny the case fully for one reason or another. They'll say the accident didn't actually happen on the job. We think it happened at home. Or the accident didn't happen because you work in a difficult factory. It happened because you were drinking alcohol the night before, things like that. So there are a lot of defenses they can raise.
Sure. So tell me, is it common then for an individual in workers' comp to feel like their employer treats them less favorably after they are injured at work?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that's really disappointing to a lot of folks and results in a lot of hurt feelings. But You know, some of my favorite clients are people who've spent their entire career working at the same place. I had a concrete worker in Valdosta who had worked at the same concrete facility driving the same dump truck for 30 years. And
you could imagine getting injured after that for 30 years.
And that you've invested your whole life with one company, you expect a certain relationship. And it's amazing how as soon as you have an injury, a completely legitimate injury, and you file that claim, all of a sudden you're seen as somehow an adversary. You know, a lot of these companies are watching those insurance premiums closely, and they really don't want anyone to report an injury. I was at a deposition in South Carolina last week, and the insurance lawyer sort of took me aside afterwards and said, hey, just off the record, you know, we've had some issues with this particular construction company. Said we actually recently had a deposition where one of the supervisors sort of let slip. He said, well, why hadn't such and such been reported? And he mentioned that the employee, quote unquote, broke the code. Well, the code was they have an unspoken code that no one is supposed to report a work injury. So you've somehow broken the fraternal order of your fellow construction workers by saying that you actually got hurt on the job, which is ridiculous, but that's what happens.
So they feel that the employers are not their advocate, but also what about their doctors that they see?
That's another one of those strange things you'll hear pretty routinely, but someone in the workers' compensation setting, part of the arrangement that exists in workers' comp is that it's a compromise. So there aren't as many remedies that you could pursue in workers' comp that you could in a personal injury case. And one of the compromises that's been created in state-based workers' compensation is that the employer gets to sort of direct who you go see. And it should come as no surprise that they pick doctors that they think are going to recommend not very much treatment.
Sure.
So what's unusual for a lot of these folks is they've never been to a doctor before, where as soon as the doctor begins interviewing them about the injury, they feel like they're being cross-examined and they're being asked questions as though they're not telling the truth.
Right.
And when the patient is telling them this particular medicine is not working, or you know, you said physical therapy and then right back to work, I'm still struggling. A lot of those doctors are simply just telling them, we don't have anything else to offer you, shuffling them out the door rather than offering additional treatment. So it's the first time someone ever in a medical setting has just kind of realized they're not being listened to.
So are they allowed to get their own physician?
They can, and sometimes people do, but that creates other problems. And an insurance company would routinely say that if you've sought medical treatment outside of workers' comp, well, that's evidence that your doctor's shopping. You must be trying to manipulate the system.
Gotcha. Yeah. So what's a good outcome? I feel like this is all so terrible.
Sounds
and you're
negative.
Really a victim, but you really have the world against you when something happens and it's just you, you know, you didn't do it on purpose. So it's not like you're doing, you know.
Right.
So what's a good outcome or end result in a workers' compensation claim?
Well, I think at its heart, what I like about workers' comp is that it's a bridge. It really only provides two things. It provides medical benefits and disability benefits. There's no pain and suffering. There's no runaway jury verdicts. It's more of an administrative system. But the thing I like about working with clients is just helping them realize that we're going to set some achievable goals in terms of trying to get a medical condition diagnosed and treated. And at some point, I hope there will be some kind of financial recovery that we can use for them to plan for the next phase of their life. For folks that are in their mid to late 50s, that may mean that they're going to enter effective retirement sooner than they thought. Right. And you're helping parlay them to someone then who could file a Social Security disability claim, or maybe I'll send someone over to Jeff to then begin pursuing their long-term disability claim once we've worked out that issue in the workers' comp. For other folks, you know, younger folks who are getting injured, you're really just helping them think about, you know, what sorts of jobs and careers are they going to have for the rest of their life. And some people realize after 10 years in manufacturing that they just simply aren't going to be able to continue to sustain that kind of physical wear and tear anymore. So you may be planning for new job certifications or things like that so they can.
Yeah. Well, we're glad to have you here, and it sounds like you definitely know what you're doing and definitely worthy of being around this round table. Let our clients, let our listeners know how they can reach you.
You can always go to our website. The law firm name is Corrales and Woody, but you just would type in CorralesWoody.com. And people in Georgia see a name of Spanish derivation like Corrales, and some folks say Corrales, and some folks who call in will say Corrales. But in any event, it is pronounced Corrales, but CorralesWoody.com would be one place you could go. Or you can call me anytime directly, 678-386-5060, and you'll get right to me.
Awesome. Awesome. Great. And Aaron, you have put this board together here today, and we'd love to hear the hot topic of nursing home abuse. But before that, I'd like to mention again our sponsors today. They are Peachtree Offices. You can see their website is www.peachtreeoffices.com. We have 3A Law Practice Management, and they are at 3alawmanagement.com. And then Atlanta's own John Marshall Law School, and those are easy to look up as well on my website at www.atlantalegalexperts.com. Aaron, I'm going to give it over to you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
I brought these group of accomplished attorneys together because I feel like we all have something in common, which is that we all represent individuals who, through no fault of their own, are experiencing some issue either with their health or with their insurance. Nathan represents workers. Sarah represents the elderly. And Jeffrey represents individuals who are in a dispute with their insurance company. Steve and I represent injured people who are either injured at the nursing home or injured going back and forth from nursing homes. And I think that it's important for all of us to, for lack of a better word, cross-pollinate our ideas, because we see the same issues over and over again.
Sure.
We see falsified documents. We see insurance companies acting in bad faith. We see our clients who are inexperienced in this process falling victim to very sophisticated, very large entities that their profit is in denying our clients their benefits or denying them care that they've already paid for.
Right.
So I'm just pleased everyone's here.
Me too.
And I want to open up the discussion now to everyone as to what trends do you see, and Steve, I guess I'll start with you, in nursing homes, do you feel like companies are becoming more proactive when a family comes into a nursing home and they have a sense that their relative or their loved one is being treated unfairly or being treated not to their wishes, not to their best interests? Is the nursing home proactive in trying to remedy that? Or do they immediately, again, in your experience, do they immediately sort of close the door and try to get the family out of the facility?
Thank you, Aaron, for having us. And Emily, thank you as well. And that's a great question. Unfortunately, a lot of times what we see is hiding of the ball, denying that there's anything wrong, and finger pointing. You have kind of all three elements going on. Because a lot of times, especially with the pressure sores or decubitus ulcers, there are people out there that will contend these things just happen, that your loved one's in a facility, they're older, and their body is just breaking down. And so often they will just tell the family, we're sorry this is happening. And a lot of times the family just accepts that. And that's why, Emily, when you said earlier, do you find that this is rare? Actually, it happens a lot. People just don't realize that it has not been reported and that it happened because somebody was negligent. There is a difference between general skin breakdown. I think anybody who's laid on the couch for an afternoon and watched college football or something may get up and is a little sore on their backside. But imagine if you've been laying on the couch watching football for 2 weeks and you never got up, you were never turned, your body will be affected by that. Mm-hmm. And also, depending on what kind of nutrition you have, will affect how your body reacts. So unfortunately, a lot of times if something's happening, a facility will ignore it, will not do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And you also have a situation where the doctor will say, well, I'm relying on the reporting of these nurses or CNAs or caretakers. And if they're not reporting what's really going on, well, then how can it be my fault? The owner of the facility that has the caretakers will in turn say, well, that's why we work with doctors. They're the professionals. They should see what's going on. So there's an inherent conflict and an inherent
just
tension.
Pointing fingers.
Exactly. They're pointing fingers at each other saying it's not my fault. So one, these things happen. And second, it's not my fault. So unfortunately, a lot of this goes unreported, undetected. I think one of the advantages we have today with social media, there's a lot more exchange of information. There ways to tell people in a general sense of what's going on. And hopefully, as the years progress, people will know more about it. But it's a real problem. And as our society is aging, I think we're going to see more of this in the years to come.
Nathan, when you have dealt with catastrophic work injuries, when treatment is finished and you're dealing with a workers' compensation claim where the claimant is never going back to work, where the claimant has to be, for lack of a better word, institutionalized, are you still stuck in the workers' comp system, or can a client of yours reach out to maybe someone like Sarah or someone like Jeffrey to try to, I guess, get better care?
Yeah, I think a lot of times, we'll use a particular term of art there, catastrophic, and in workers' compensation, that has particular meaning, and that could mean an individual that's on workers' compensation for the rest of their life. And that's a pretty unique situation. You're dealing with very severe injuries, amputations, paralysis, things like that. And yes, there is going to be some overlap there, particularly once they get into their Social Security years and things like that. There's going to be overlap with federal programs. But in cases, aside from just the catastrophic setting, there's just a tremendous amount of overlap in workers' comp cases. And it's amazing to see all the ways this comes out. But there are cases where someone is being taken by non-emergency medical transport from their home to a workers' comp appointment, and they have that accident that you were describing earlier. They weren't clicked in. They go to pull them out of the van, and the person just falls flat on the asphalt, and they sustain a new injury. And they've got what's called in workers' comp a super added injury at that point. They have a new injury, which is still ultimately connected to that original injury. They wouldn't have been there in that time and place but for that original injury. However, there's also been an incident of negligence now. So you've got another responsible party that also is on the hook for taking care of some of what's happened there. As you can imagine, if there are two insurance companies involved and there's any opportunity for them to point the finger at each other, well, they're certainly going to do that.
Right. There,
we had another case at a nursing home one time where the individual was being brought to the nursing home by the family, and the nursing home apparently had some kind of policy about, well, they're supposed to get out of the car by themselves. Once they get into the facility, that's when the employees kick in. But in this particular incident, the individual in the car went into some kind of cardiac arrest, and the nursing home had a policy about an alarm going off if there was a certain emergent incident. So this was like a blue light incident, or they had some name for it. But an alarm goes off, and this employee goes out to help the person who's experiencing this emergency out of their car, ends up straining their back as they're bent over trying to pull someone out of a car. And the insurance company later denied it, saying that wasn't a part of their job, because their job requirement it tells them they're not supposed to help someone out of the car in the parking lot. They're supposed to begin assisting them once they get inside the premises.
Oh,
but so it's
goodness.
That kind of thing. I mean, there's just an amazing amount of game playing that's being that's going on when there are overlapping insurance policies.
Wow, that really gives you faith in humanity. So so Sarah, if that claim were to take place where the person was pulling the man who had a cardiac arrest and the person who hurt their back, let's say he, as you mentioned earlier, let's say he planned ahead and he had disability insurance and he had long-term care, would he be able to use those insurance policies, or would he have to, if you were looking for a workers' compensation claim, would he have to be stuck within the workers' compensation system?
Long-term care policies are generally written such that benefits become payable when the insured can't perform several activities of daily living. And activities of daily living are things like walking or using the restroom or bathing on one's own. So this is generally a situation where someone needs care providers to help them with these activities, either in an institution like a nursing home or in an assisted living facility, or sometimes at home with paid caregivers. So we do see it in the disability context. It's definitely possible, but probably more often in the aging context. And usually the policies are written so that there's a certain dollar amount paid per day for a certain benefit period. So 3 years or 5 years at X dollars per day. And there's, you know, any number of combinations of benefits that you could see. So looking at policies and how beneficial they are just depends on what that dollar amount is.
Are you starting to see more and more overlap? Because as the population ages, conversely, no one's retiring, right? Everyone's working past 65. I have relatives who are working into their 70s. So you have these different programs that are meant for one segment of the population just starting to overlap. Do you see that very often?
I haven't seen that personally, but I can definitely imagine how that would be the case. And it's interesting from my perspective in talking about aging, how differently people age, because you can have a 70-year-old who is, you know, as active as a 30-year-old, or I can see a 70-year-old individual who has aged a whole lot more. There's more and more cases of early onset Alzheimer's disease and dementia. You know, we see people even in their late 40s or 50s who have been diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's disease. And that's definitely a situation where long-term care insurance is a huge benefit because as many people understand, the cost of skilled nursing home care is, you know, is astronomical. It can be $80,000, $100,000 a year. So if a younger individual is diagnosed with a condition that requires long-term care and they have a spouse who needs to live off of those resources for another 30 or 40 years, it's really a catastrophic financial situation, among other things.
Steve, do you see that in your nursing home abuse where I know you discussed ulcers earlier, decubitus ulcers, but people going into the nursing home who are otherwise physically healthy but have dementia, have early onset Alzheimer's, that's a different level of care they need. Is that correct?
Yes. A lot of times the ulcers affect people who are immobile or are unable to communicate. Places like Sunshine deal with Alzheimer's patients that are still mobile. They just don't have all their facilities with them.
That just opens up a different level of risk, correct?
Yes, that's right. That those situations, you have to make sure that a proper number of caretakers are around, for example, helping mom get out of bed, into a wheelchair, get into the bathroom or back to their bed. Some places will have one person assigned to that task. For other people, they may need a second person. As Woody mentioned earlier about the dead weight, it's very difficult to help somebody get up who cannot help themselves.
You and I live in Decatur, and I feel like at least once a month we'll hear a report of someone who's just wandered, who's just gone missing. And otherwise they look healthy, but they don't know who they are and they don't know where they live. And that to me is almost more frightening because if I were to pass that person on the street, I wouldn't know anything's wrong with them. Yet they're a danger to themselves because they don't know what they're doing. And I feel like that is got to be, it is the nursing home's responsibility to make sure that person is taken care of and not hurting themselves. Have you ever seen cases like that where an otherwise healthy person has ended up hurting themselves because the nursing home wasn't properly staffed or properly supervising?
Yes. I had one case about 5 years ago, a gentleman who was relatively healthy, was in a facility, and he started to develop an ulcer, and they wanted to provide certain level of care, and he kept saying no, no, no. And so they didn't provide the treatment, which was really just going to be creams and some medication. And it turned out he just, because he didn't have all of his facilities, he didn't understand what they were suggesting, and it became a terrible situation mm-hmm. where migrated to a stage 4 ulcer, and he was never able to walk again. So you have professionals that are supposed to look at the medical condition and know how to handle a medical condition. As a lay person, all I can do is say my arm hurts, my leg hurts, but I depend on my doctors to tell me what's wrong and what needs to be done to help the situation.
So we've got to wrap it up just a little bit, but we've talked about how to find a reputable non-emergency medical transportation company. What are some advice that you can give to the people listening? Jeff and whoever wants to answer the question, how do you find a good reputable nursing home company?
I'm not sure I'm the person to speak to nursing. My practice is more looking for the right insurance company.
And I actually wanted to ask Jeff real quickly. Jeff, when you have a client who's been treated unfairly by the insurance company, and let's say they were experiencing early onset Alzheimer's or some sort of dementia, they're already at a disadvantage when dealing with the insurance company. Are there any guidelines or any protections with these insurance claims that are built into the process?
Not exactly. I think it's really up to someone external to be their advocate and to get them to adequate legal representation. It's going to be a doctor or a family member that first steps in to try to help them, and then ultimately hope they'll find a lawyer.
Is that where a lot of your clients come, when a family member knows they're being treated unfairly?
Absolutely. I mean, like I say, these are usually pretty severely sick and injured people, and they may lack the mental capacity or the physical energy to advocate for themselves, and so they need a lot of help.
So they're already more vulnerable than usual.
Correct? Exactly, yeah. Exactly. They need a lot of support.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Okay, well, we are glad that everybody was here today, and unfortunately we have to wrap it up, but we could definitely have everybody back, and we can speak more towards this topic, because there's definitely a lot more to cover. Thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning in, and we look forward to next week's show. My name is Emily Rowell, and I'm with Peachtree Offices, and this has been another episode of Atlanta Legal Experts.